The subject's going to our second page. The rest of the five things that the four Gospels all agree on are all mentioned in their record. Now, we just finished which one? They all agreed on or had betrayal. All right, now the next one we have here in point B is the unjust trial by the high priest. He didn't get a fair trial. All of that, you see, contributes to the suffering of it. First, we have Matthew 26, verse 57 through 62. Well, now you see stressed there, false witnesses. Now, what could be more unfair in a trial, and I'm sure he's not the first or last trial that had to undergo that, to have the witnesses, those that are accusing him, being false, absolutely lying, not telling the truth. And of course, that's something we abhor, to see someone on trial with false witnesses against them. Well, that was against this wonderful man, the Son of God. We just point out some things that I think each of the gospel writers can show us, maybe some more than others. Mark 14, verses 55 through 65, the next reader reads that portion.
And the chief priests and all the council sought for witnesses against Jesus to put him to death, and found none. For many bear false witnesses against him, but their witnesses agreed not together. And there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But neither so did their witnesses say, I am, and ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes and saith, What need we any further witness? Ye have heard the blasphemy. What think ye? And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to buffet him and to say unto him, Prophesy. And the servants did strike him with palms of their hands.
Yes. Well, now, what I noted down was the inordinate brutality right there in his trial. Now, I think only one trial. I remember a literal trial when I was a teenager, a murder trial. I guess most of our contact with him would be through the tube. I don't know how much true to life they are, but at least... You don't see this happening normally. What kind of a trial of justice would it be? They're trying to condemn him. He hasn't been declared guilty. You see, the man that has to declare him guilty is the Roman. These people are just giving their accusation. They are the accusers. And so, but without him even being condemned, that is of the, they say condemn him, but the man, the judge, is Pilate. Well, soon as they say he's guilty, in their own minds, think of this now. Some of them would just read over this. It's prophesied in the Old Testament. Isaiah and some of the others speak of these things they would do, but spit on him. And you know who it says is doing this? These are the priests. See up in verse 55 where Gilbert started reading? The chief priests, all the council, that's the venerable council, the supposedly dignified council of the great the high ups of the Jewish religion, supposed to be pious, right kind of men, righteous men. Well, as soon as they somehow shows again the power that the devil is moving them, they spit on him. That's about as much an act of scorn as I think you can do on a human being, if you mean it, I mean on purpose, spit on them. And to cover his face, put something over his face, and then started hitting him, buffet him. And then telling him, mocking him, telling him to prophesy. I think maybe we'll read that in a minute. One of them says what they want him to prophesy. And then the servants, even those that aren't supposed to be so high up in the social structure, they find that they start hitting him with the palms of their hands like that. I guess they, I own it harder than that, I'm sure. And so that had nothing to do with his cross. That's not where he's redeeming us. But it just shows the diabolical and man and sinful man and devil in cahoots that their unfairness, unjust. No, there's no kind of a trial like that. I don't know if the Pilate saw all of that. I don't know. No, this was in the I don't think he would allow that. Well, I don't know, Herod, they did mock him and start that crown of thorns and all that. But it didn't say that Pilate, it doesn't seem like he was in on that kind of thing. And so let's go to Luke and see. Luke stresses something else, 22 verses 64 through 71.
When they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, Prophet, say, who is that? Who is it that smote thee?
Yeah.
And many other things blasphemously spake they against him. And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council, saying, Art thou the Christ? Tell us. And he said unto them, If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God. Then said they all, Art thou then the Son of God? And he said unto them, You say that I am. And they said, What need we any further witness? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth.
So I would say the point there that Luke brings out, there's an attempt to make him, well, I suppose you could try to get a confession out of him, but that's part of the judge, of the real civil authority. Seems like all they're trying to do is make him say something, declare his deity, or catch him off guard, make him actually to testify against himself. Well, they were tricky. That's the way, of course, it's done in many trials. But he had to go on to go all those underhandedness against him. And then you have something else, which we've already had, but John shows it how it was authorized. John chapter 18, verses 19 through 23.
The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Jesus answered him, I spake openly to the world. I never taught in the synagogues and in the temple, whether the Jews always resort and in secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. And when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? Jesus answered him, If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me?
So you see who authorized the physical violence against him at his own trial. That is before the Sanhedrin, the ranking officials of the Jewish religion, Judaism. The officers, one of those of authority. And the high priest didn't do anything to stop him. They said he'd been disrespectful to the high priest. Says, why do you ask me? Ask those that heard me. And so they had him, struck him with the palm of his hand, right there in the trial. Well, that's quite an unjust trial, I would say. Well, the next one, we have Pilate's verdict of Jesus. Now, though he delivered him to die, apparently God saw that Pilate gave his opinion. Pilate, he was not, at that time anyway, a righteous man. He was just a Jewish, I would call him a politician. He's fairly authoritative, pretty well high up in the Jewish, and then the Roman, he's Roman, in the Roman authority. He was one of the governor of the area where Jesus was, of Jerusalem there, was being condemned. And his verdict was that Jesus Christ was innocent of any crime. All right, let's follow down and see how each one of them, of the four gospel writers presented. First, Matthew 27, 22 to 25.
Pilate saith unto them, What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called Christ? They all say unto him, Let him be crucified. And the governor said, Why? What evil hath he done? But they cry out the more, saying, Let him be crucified. When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this righteous person. See ye to it. Then answered all the people and said, His blood be on us and on our children.
A very ominous thing they said. But still, evidently they understood. He knew the Jews liked symbolism. They had things, their religion are quite ceremonial, and they go through all these forms and acts to show a point. Well, he washed his hands, took water, and says, this is the way I am. I'm free. I'm innocent from the blood of this, what kind of person? Just or righteous person. In other words, he is guilty of no crime. He's a just person. And then in Mark 15, we'll read verses 9 through 15. See how he says it. Well, He didn't say, I know he's innocent, exactly like Matthew indicated, but he certainly brings it out in the same thought. Verse 14, why? They said, crucify him. He says, why? What evil hath he done? In his examination, both of Jesus and anything they'd said, he hadn't found any evil. Why? What evil has he done? Well, they didn't tell him there. All they wanted now was crucify him. That's all. That's all they were after. But they didn't do it. See, it always sounds like people think they did. No. God was in charge of this whole thing. And then in Luke chapter 23, verses 20 through 24.
Pilate therefore, willing to release Jesus, spake again to them, but they cried, saying, crucify him, crucify him. And he said unto them a third time, why, what evil hath he done? And I found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. And they were instant with loud voices, crying that he might be crucified. The voices of them and of the chief priests prevailed. Finally, gave sentence that it should be as they
require. Okay, and there were voices of the mob, voices of this degenerate priesthood prevailed, but Pilate still says, why? What evil hath he done? I have found no cause of death in him. I know some think Pilate was saved. Well, I hope so, because I would certainly have to come up. It would be terrible to have to come up before that the same man in his final, that white throne of judgment, already in God's eternal words saying, he had already said, I found no cause of death in him, and yet he delivered him over to be crucified. Terrible, terrible, a terrible judgment if he never did repent. John, now there's a mistake there. I think it says, what does it say there in the next point? 4, John, what chapter? Well, it's 18. John 18, verses 28 through 38. That's kind of a long passage. Who's next there? 28 through 38.
Then led they Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Pilate then went out unto them and said, what accusation bring ye against this man? They answered and said unto him, if he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up unto thee. Then said Pilate unto them, take ye him and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again, and called Jesus, and said unto him, art thou the king of the Jews? Jesus answered him, sayest thou this thing of thyself? Or did others tell it thee of me? Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered. But now is my kingdom not from hence. Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. Pilate saith unto him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews, and saith unto them, I find in him no fault at all.
Isn't that pretty strong? That was his final conclusion as a civil judge. I find in him no fault at all. And then he delivered him over anyway. Well, the next one we have they all talked about was, and this is one of the greatest blows, Barabbas over Jesus. In their estimation, they chose Barabbas over Jesus. Let's go to Matthew 27, 15 to 21.
Now at that feast, the governor was wont to release unto the people a prisoner whom they would. And they had then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered him. When he was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, have thou nothing to do with that just man? For I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said unto them, whether of the twain will ye that I release unto you? They said, Barabbas.
So, each one tell about what this man was, his character. It's the verse 16, as Nick read, says he was a notable prisoner. And then he asked, according to their custom on that feast day, was to release some prisoner. And so he gave him, it sounds like this was his attempt to get out of this situation. He knew how bad this fellow was. And I don't believe he could fathom the fact that they would choose to throw him back on society instead of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ wasn't a bad man to have around. He healed the sick, the lame, the deaf, the dumb. He raised the dead several times. He had delivered people from sins and gave them a decent life. He went about doing good. They didn't want that man back in their midst. You know, sometimes, we're not like that because the Lord has delivered us, but do you ever had an uncomfortable feeling? I'm kind of ashamed of belonging to this crowd, this humanity. Yep, it is. It's kind of a shame. Well, we could have been that way too if it wasn't for him. He died for our sins. Well, there's one more thought. I think I want to bring in that last part about the burial, and it's not so long, but I don't think we'll be able to read every one of these scriptures, so let's just follow down the points. We already have seen there that Barabbas was chosen, but I do want to find the one that tells to get the full picture of what kind of a criminal he was. That says he was a notable prisoner. That would indicate he had some notable crime. But let's see what Mark says. Mark 15. I want to check the one that'll give us one of them, I think, gives you the full picture of him. However, it may take three of them, 15, 7, and 11. Yeah, I think Mark, he will pretty well give you what he was. Just read the first verse. You know what happened? They chose Barabbas back to be freed among them. Well, here's what they wanted to be loose among them. Kind of sound a little like some things we know today. Matthew 15, verse 7. Next reader.
And there was one named Barabbas, which lay bound with them that had made insurrection with him, who had committed murder in the insurrection.
Now, you understand what an insurrection is? Okay. It's a rebellion against the government. Mm-hmm. Now, the Romans, that's one reason I think Pilate thought that surely they wouldn't take him, they were very sensitive, we brought that out in some of our studies previously, against any kind of rebellion against their authority. They weren't too bad if you submitted to them, but they were ruthless if you didn't. Well, here's one that had risen against the Roman government in prison, and then he also tells what he did during that insurrection. He committed murder. Okay, I think, now one of them will tell, so he's an insurrectionist against the civil authority, he's a murderer, and let's see what Luke says. There's one other item that goes with it, I mean, it's not all that different, that tells what he was. It may be John, but I'll see. Luke, let's look in Luke 23 and see if that's how he describes him. See, Luke 23, what have I got there, 13 to 18. Yeah, this also tells he's sedition, which means an uprising against the government, and for murder. Well, it'd have to be John that tells it, the other part of his base character. John 18, verse 39 and 40.
You have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will you therefore that I release unto you the King of the Jews? Then cried they all again, saying, Not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber.
Okay. In the social structure, do you feel comfortable? Somebody loose among you that's a professional robber? Well, that's what they seem to prefer to Jesus Christ. The only man among them would do nothing but good. The devil and man shows what a pretty base bunch they are, don't they? Well, I'll not read them, but I think you want to check the scriptures later. Some of the points that each of the writers bring out. He was crucified. Now that next point, E, we just follow the scriptures and the account of each gospel writer of his crucifixion. Well, Matthew, you can find stressed, he was exposed to the public. It shows the people passing by, mocking him, the priests, the soldiers that crucified him sat there and gaped at him, and others came by and mocked him and so forth. And all that was public. See, it wasn't any kind of a private sentence or execution. It was all open to the public. Mark stresses that way they mocked him as he was there. Come down from the cross and so forth. You're such a the Son of God and all that. And then Luke tells about the covetousness of those the soldiers and all. They parted his garments right there at the bottom of the cross, completely calloused. And then Luke also tells us that he delivered his spirit into the hands of the Father. It was a voluntary death. And then John tells quite a bit of his suffering and about the fact that it was normally a lengthy ordeal, but God did cause it to be short for him. That doesn't mean there was less suffering, but that he's remembering the soldiers. He tells about the soldiers coming around to break their legs because the next day was a feast day and they wanted to kill them quickly. Otherwise, they'd have lived on through the next day. I think sometimes this lasted a few days. It's amazing. You don't know how anybody could concoct it, this kind of a suffering. They had it just down to the T, just how to make it suffer and continue. I don't know how they figured it out, but I guess that's the way they were. Probably the devil showed them out. Anyway, it was a suffering that was lengthy, but God caused his to be shortened. Now it all added up. His crucifixion, I have a few points that you can see in there. Extreme cruelty, suffering that is physical and also the soul, ridicule, humiliation. I would say it all sums up the sin of man. Men did that to the Son of God. Things unique to each gospel. One of these points we have here you would find in Matthew tells us something others don't, that after his resurrection, but it gives it the time of his death and his burial, that the other saints of the Old Testament, that is, we think it was of my overcomers, that their graves were opened and they came out. And we would think, according to the records in Hebrews 11, they went to heaven. Mark tells about a young man who they tried to catch him when they went to take Jesus, you know, that mob that came after him, that one of them grabbed him and thought he was with him, and he left his garment and fled, ran. Well, that shows the shame of the cross. Many think that, and likely, well, it was Mark himself, because nobody else mentions that. And Luke, he tells of the terminal blow to humanity by the cross. He told that to the women that were weeping for him. He says, now don't weep for me, weep for yourselves and for your nation. Because the way he says it, that was the end of humanity, and the only hope for them was to accept his cross. John says the final utterance, it is finished. He tells us that. So the complete redemption was effected by his death on the cross. Now let's go to the next one. It isn't so obvious. It's always a little more difficult to figure out why this is one of the foundations, but it must be because God put it here. And that he was buried. He died for his sins, and he was buried. Well, I'll read the introduction there to that thought in lesson 18. It's called the second foundation. Back there, if you would go to 1 Corinthians 1, 15, verses 1, 2, and on, it says he died and that he was buried. It's not so evident, as we have said, to the spiritual meaning as the others. But I just looked up when we prepared these lessons that the Jews did, in their tradition, they insisted on burial. And as you find out its connection, there were other methods of the disposal of the body at that time too. And the notable one, I found out, was cremation. We think that's something new. No, it was done in ancient times. But the Jews didn't want that. They wanted burial. That must have been something maybe God had instilled in them. And then if you follow the scripture, you'll find that they felt it pointed to resurrection. There's a connection between the burial and the resurrection, which was one of their fundamental doctrines, the resurrection. We'll find examples of how insistent they were on that. In Genesis 50, 25 and 26, that's the end of the record of Joseph, who died in Egypt, a foreign land, but he had the faith that his people would go back to their land. And lo and behold, see what he asked that they do. Some next reader read Genesis 50, verses 25 and 26. This is the great Joseph as he died.
And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt.
Now he wanted them to take his bones with them when he went. When they went back to the land. All right, we have it fulfilled or continued in Exodus 13, 18, and 19. Moses was now in charge of the nation coming out of Egypt, and you'll find that this charge of Joseph hadn't been forgotten. This was many years later, I think several hundred. Next, we read Exodus 13, 18, and 19. These are the words of Moses.
But God led the people about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up, harnessed out of the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straightly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones away hence with you.
So Moses remembered and saw that they were going to take his bones. Now, what happened to those bones? Joshua 24:32. Here's the end of the record of them actually entering the land, the promised land of Canaan, became their land. Joshua 24:32, the great leader here.
And the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem in a parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and became the inheritance of the children of Joseph.
So that's what Joseph wanted his bone, where he wanted none of them, to be buried. He says they were buried in this area. And there's an area of the family burial place from way back, from the time of Jacob. And then in Hebrews 11:22, that doesn't seem like any great thing, but you see how great his it was an act of faith, declaration of faith that Joseph, and this is a marvel because of all the things he did there in Egypt and the things God did through him, this is the one that's recorded as his crowning act of faith. Hebrews 11, verse 22.
By faith, Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones.
Yes. Now this is it doesn't ever say it, but in the book of Hebrews, it tells about the worthies of the Old Testament that looked for the heavenly city. And so evidently, Joseph wanted his bones buried there that they might come out of there, as we saw there in Matthew, or we mentioned about it, the graves of many were open after the resurrection of Christ. So he showed his goal for a better resurrection. There's a connection between the burial and the faith of resurrection. And we'll see a little further in the scriptures about in 1 Corinthians 15. But first, just to see something about burial. Now, this doesn't guarantee to happen. This is the only occasion you have it recorded ever. But look what happened once in a burial. 2 Kings 13, 20 and 21. There'd been a war. I'll give you the background of that. The Syrians, I believe, or was it the Moabites, you'll find there, were invading, and a man was slain, and I think the enemy was coming down on him, and they wanted to get rid of his body quickly, and so let's see what happened. 2 Kings 13, verse 20 and 21.
And Elisha died, and they buried him, and the bands of the Moabites invaded the land at the coming in of the year. And it came to pass, as they were burying a man, that behold, they spied a band of men, and they cast the man into the sepulchre of Elisha. And when the man was let down and touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet.
Yep, it's comical, but it's a tremendous thing. There was power still in the bones of Elijah, the power of resurrection. So there is a connection between the burial and the resurrection and the faith of the resurrection. Now, how about church truth? Well, Paul joins these two things of burial and resurrection. For the believers in Romans 6 and 4, he uses the figure of baptism, which we find out there, is a matter of identification of the believer with Christ. And we know what Christ did, and then we find out what happened to Christ, and that happens to the believer too, and it's symbolized by baptism, water baptism. Romans 6, verse 4. Yeah, so you go through by the symbol, or this example, or ceremony, of baptism. There's not a merit in itself, like there's no merit in any ceremony. But it's what it represents, and therefore it becomes a precious thing to us. God tells it, orders it. You're identified with Christ in death, but you're identified with him in your burial, the ending of a creation, and you're identified with the beginning of a new creation. He rose. Colossians 2 and 12 gives a further confirmation of that. The combination of burial and resurrection. life, new life. Colossians 2 and 12. So you're buried with him. So that ends, that seems like not too much, but it's a very, very significant and great thing. Buried with him in baptism, and you're identified with him in death. Risen with him through faith is that, for he has raised Christ, so we're raised up in a new life too. Not just here, you know. We have an experience drawing on his resurrection, but our final resurrection hasn't happened yet. But it just as sure. Now, we have something about Christ's own personal burial. In Isaiah 53 and 9, it tells us that, we had all of that terrible thing that he went through, and it was all negative, all seemed like it was all downhill to the very bottom, the dregs of humanity. But it was prophesied that very quickly that order was going to be reversed, that down part of it. Isaiah 53, verse 9,
And he made his grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth.
Now that's the prophecy of his Christ's vicarious offering. Well, he did identify himself with the wicked, that's what we said, wicked when he died. But right off, with the rich. And that's how he fulfilled. And I think that whole thing about Matthew 27:50-7-60, let's read that. You can see in the record about the kings of old and even in the time of Christ that the kind of a burial to them, the kind that you had, seemed to them a signal of what kind of a person you were and what was your expectation.
When the evening was come, there came a rich man of
Arimathea
named Joseph, who also himself was a disciple. He went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be delivered. And when Joseph had taken the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and laid it on his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock, and he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulchre and departed.
See, that's an example. This was a rich man. Notice, a rich man. But he was a believer, a disciple. And he went and got him and put him in his own rich man's tomb. I think that was, a rich man did him the honor of burying him. Now we could follow down, there's some very interesting parts in each one of them, but I want to also go to John 19:38-41 to show that the others don't tell us that, but there was another man involved here, which is very interesting. It's a man you've heard of before in the gospel record in John. John 19:38-41.
And after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him leave. He came therefore and took the body of Jesus. And there came also Nicodemus, which at the first came to Jesus by night, and brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pound weight.
And that was costly. Go ahead, Sister Ruth.
Then took they the body of Jesus, and wound it in linen clothes with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified there was a garden, and in the garden a new sepulchre, wherein was never man yet laid. There laid they Jesus therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day, for the sepulchre was nigh at hand.
So he was buried by rich men, in a rich fashion, with all the, it was kind of hidden in a way, but and then I think we have a very important thing there. It tells about the garden there, and I'm sure there's a meaning there, that Jesus' burial speaks of good things to come. There's a garden. It's Psalm 16. I feel that is a psalm that expresses the thoughts of Jesus when his body was in the tomb, and his spirit was in the heart of the earth, upper Sheol. And it shows, see, during his burial, there was he was alive, the soul, the spirit was alive. And these are his thoughts and his word, Psalm 16. This is not fanciful, because Peter in a later sermon speaks of the words of the Lord, referring to the Lord. So we'll read there verses 5 and 6 to show the spirit and attitude of Jesus during the time of his, while his body was in the burial state.
The Lord is a portion of mine inheritance and of my cup. Thou maintainest my life. The lions are fallen unto me in pleasant places. Yea, I have a goodly heritage.
He's not expecting anything bad anymore. He was optimistic. Verse 7.
I will bless the Lord who hath given me counsel. My heart also instructs me in its season.
He was worshipful there in the heart of the earth. Verse 8, next.
I have set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand. I shall not be moved.
So he is very confident. I've set the Lord before me. I'll not always be here. He was only there 3 days, 3 nights. Verses 9 and 10, this tells something in his burial even about his body.
Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory rejoiceth, and my flesh also shall rest in hope. For thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou suffer thy holy one to see corruption.
So the hell there is their word of Sheol, which was a place of paradise at that time before. But it was a good place. But his body is referring to about his flesh. He's given his expectation of resurrection, will not leave my soul here. But his body was not allowed to decay. And I'm sure the reason was because he was holy. There was no sin about him, and he was not to be viewed in that way as sinner. So there's an important thing about his burial. And then verse 11 gives his final spiritual outlook.
Thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore.
That's one of the beautiful scriptures that tells you about the eternal condition of man. Joy, fullness, trullus, life to its full, pleasures. So death in itself is not a virtue. Death pays the way for life. 1 Corinthians 15, 42 to 44. I think that tells us that burial for us has a significance.
So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body, and there is a spiritual body.
And I believe in that, and we'll see the figure now in another verse, which we're going to have to correct too because of a mistake, that the seed of life is there in the burial. It's very plain in this chapter when you see it, but for many years I did not see it. It was maybe 15 years ago. There was one sister which was present and probably officiated at the laying away of a sister. I'd known her, and I remember how it came to me. When the body is placed there, there's a seed. Not that the body is anything anymore. See, it's done for. See, it's sown, it is corruption. It decays. But there's a seed there. Now, I don't understand it, but you're dealing with God. And so the seed of life is in the burial of the body. If you want to see the figure, then it's in verse, we have here 47, but it's 37. The figure of speech that God uses, which makes it very plain. In that same chapter, verse 37, next one we'll read it.
And that which thou sowest not that body that shall be bare grain, and may chance of wheat or of some other man.
See, he uses the figure of speech. This is the time of year. You plant seed. Well, you don't get that seed anymore. You get a life that comes from that seed. And it's exactly the same thing as the resurrection of the body. Hebrews 2, 16 and 17. Why did he go through all of that? Burial and so forth. Well, I probably included in this thought about the why of all of his earthly existence. Hebrews 2, verses 16 and 17. And we can't redeem anybody, but he says, all things be made like unto his brethren. He went through the whole way that we go. Life, the very small, we make so much of it, and it is wonderful, but it's a very small segment of all the believers that are going to be translated. Very small. The mass of them go to the grave. Some still are. And he went that way to show us. He went through the whole thing. Life, death, burial, and he has been resurrected. And he's left his seed with us. So shall we be.